He was well known as a scholar and someone who supports the concept of unity and the Islamic Republic foundation and the leadership. He was receiving a lot of death threats and the pressures from external sources and so forth, but he really was one of those exceptional scholars, Sunni scholars, who was not only believing in it, but was extremely vocal in his support. And in reality, I think we need to understand that this is the position of overwhelming majority of Sunnis within Iran. I was in Qish last year, and when I went around and I saw the sort of reflection of the unity, you know, there were Shia mosque, Sunni mosque, Adhan, few sort of minutes in different timing. But, you know, people, and when you talk to people, everybody wasn't seeing what the problem is. And Qishm is one of those areas where it's almost 50-50. And people were articulating to me that they intermarried. They really didn't see problem there. The problem seems to be more something is a creation of an image that is created outside by sort of individual sort of agents and those who actually want to create disunity. And we know that divide and rule is one of the things colonials have done and used as effectively over years and years.
Do you think that that's what we're seeing happening now in the south, east of the country? You think that perhaps there's some kind of attempt to divide Sunnis and Shias?
Oh, this has been going on since the beginning of the revolution. I mean, if you look at how many anti-Shia books were before the revolution, you hardly could see it. You know, there was probably one or two. When you look at the Ikhwan al-Muslimin sort of leadership, there was always Shia and Sunni sort of representation, even at that level. And but what we are seeing now after the revolution, there were books after books after books being published in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, pumping this sort of idea of these are others, they're not one of us. And I remember in UK, I was running and was involved in running of a mosque. And as everybody knows, I've come from a Shia background. But the mosque was actually a Sunni mosque. And I was the vice president of it in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And we were going around trying to find Qurans from different places. And when we went and approached, you know, Central Mosque and other places in London to get some Qurans, we couldn't find Qurans. But they were actually willing to give us tons and tons of books which are sectarian promotion. So really that was happening just very clearly, and you could see it so clearly, and that has continued since then till now and has become more sophisticated.
For sure. Sheikh Hanif, let me bring you in on this discussion, because again, you've been to Iran, you know perhaps what it's really like there behind the negative headlines which we've seen circulating around. Last episode, we discussed the fact that there are anti-Iran protests going on right now, but it seems like this assassination of a minority religious leader is something different here. What's your impression of what's going on in Iran right now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I don't think it's different. I think, first of all, you know, it's a natural human tendency to love each other. That's the most powerful tendency, right? You know, people of different ethnic groups, racial groups, religious groups, and so on, living together normally, all right, they will build bridges with each other. The differences or hostility between these groups always come from the outside and always come from people who find, or communities or countries or whatever, or political interests and so forth, that find it important for you to have a division in order to control for their benefit. Okay? As Brother Mahsoud, you know, correctly stated, before the Islamic Revolution, you know, you would hardly find anti-Shia books in the Sunni community. Okay? after the Islamic Revolution, which is calling for the Muslims to overthrow Western imperialist domination, okay, you find a plethora of anti-Shia books in the community, and even anti-Sunni type of things also appearing in the Sunni community by those people who are partners in that project. Okay, so that project is not, it will exploit both sides. Okay, now when we are talking about the Mahsa Amini thing, all right, it is quite interesting that first of all, yes, you had this anti-Shia stuff going on and a lot of infiltration into Iran and so on. But you also find it coincides with the Russia-Ukraine war, you know, and the fact that Iran is supporting Russia, you see, in this. And if you see the increased intensity, right, for example, in places like Pakistan, you know, making almost extortionate demands on countries in Africa and Asia and so forth, to force people to take a side on this, you see this Mahsa Amini thing started to ramp up. Okay, so I think the assassination of Shahid Rig and, you know, the Mahsa Amini thing and the Russia-Ukraine aspect, all of these things are coming together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And with respect to Iran, they're using classical, I don't know if you'd call it soft power or you know, regime change by stoking what are not really divisions, but could potentially be divisions in a society. For example,
they're
divisions
looking for wiggle room, somewhere to exploit.
Yeah, you know, divisions in belief, male female type of things. You know, youth. You know, older generation things. Right. Mm. All of these things are natural, sort of like you know, not really divisions, but you know, categories in society, if one could call it that, you see?
And potential areas to exploit that. Use the economy to their benefit, that type
of
thing.
Exactly.
Yes, you know? For sure.
So I think, you know, people who are, you know, cognizant of the trends of history would be able to pick that up.
Now, Masoud, before we move on to the next segment, you've got about a minute left or so. I want to ask you, we don't actually know. I think there's been some arrests made, but they're still investigating who conducted this assassination. Could you perhaps give your opinion on who potentially could be behind it? What are the anti-Iran groups that are active at the moment?
Well, really, to pinpoint who did it at the name and the sort of so forth, it is difficult. That's a security forces thing. But it's obvious that those who are threatening him, those who actually want to create this conflict, those who want to create this otherization, that separation, as the brother said, those are the ones behind it. What they seem to be concentrating on is to turn Iran to another Libya, to another Syria. And for that, any division, any conflict is actually is picked up and amplified. And this amplification is also seen more outside, like Syria and Libya, seen more outside than inside. But also, I think what is important for people inside to recognize is that the lives of everyone in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan was shattered through this intervention and conflict creation of the West, and which has served no one except the weapon manufacturers and the State of Israel to have a conflict in the whole region.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your opinion so far. We are going to come back to the discussion. But first, let's take a moment to browse through some online opinions and reactions to the shocking and disturbing news of the scholar's assassination. We have a tweet coming here which says, all praise be to Allah and to Muhammad and his blessed family. May God preserve the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is from Abu Muhammad 16, who adds that His Eminence, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, and all of those who are working vigilantly to protect the Islamic Republic, Godspeed to them. We have another tweet coming in from Ashraf as well, who gives a very strong opinion. He makes a very valid point, saying that may his soul be rest in peace. It's tragic how the enemies of Islam and peace despise Muslim unity. Remember, Martin Luther King was supposedly ready to unite with Malcolm X. All of a sudden, there was an assassination attempt, a very valid point, I think, which can be used to compare perhaps what's happening here in Iran. Let's move on to Rahul now, who comes in with another strong opinion, who adds that he makes very, very clear that they should arrest all of these terrorists, do whatever they have to in order to resolve the situation. These terrorists want to turn Iran into another Libya or Syria. And finally, let's move over to an opinion coming in from JJ, again on Twitter, who says, killed by those looking to turn Shia and Sunni against one another for political gain. Just think who would gain from that. Sectarianism is a tried and tested tactic used by Western powers to divide and rule the Muslim world. That's absolutely clear. This next report touches on how and why these tactics have been successful in the past and used to weaken the Ummah so much.
Western colonialists have long sought to drive a wedge between Sunnis and Shias across the Muslim world as a means to divide and weaken the Muslims. And this is also the case in Iran, which has a large minority of Sunni Muslims living within its borders. Sunni Islam and Shia Islam are the two great Islamic orthodoxies which comprise the vast majority of the Muslim Ummah. Sunnis believe that the Prophet's companion, Abu Bakr, Umar and Uthman were his rightful successors, where Shias believe that the Prophet's son-in-law and cousin Ali should have been his heir. At first, the differences between the two Islamic strands were simply political, but they later developed some theological differences too. That said, the commonalities between the two main strands of Islam are far greater than their differences, and Sunnis and Shias have largely coexisted in harmony throughout Islamic history. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has repeatedly emphasized the need for Islamic unity so that the Ummah can successfully revive. He has also repeatedly said that Shias must not harm the sanctities of the Sunnis. But despite this, the imperialists and Takfiris are trying to falsely claim Iran is anti-Sunni, with the ultimate goal of weakening the Islamic Republic.
Well, let's head back to our guest discussion now, and I'm going to bring in Sheikh Hanif once again. Tell me, you was in Iran for many, many years. You know what it's really like there. There seems to be this misconception pushed sometimes that Iran is like this Shia majority country, which is intolerant to its Sunni minority. And I've heard things like there are no Sunni mosques in Tehran, for example. Could you just clarify if that's the case or not?
I have traveled quite extensively in the south of Iran, where a lot of the Sunni population is concentrated. I've also been to Kurdistan, which is quite majority Sunni. And I see on the community level, there is no hostility. There's intermarriage. You know, Sunnis have their own masajid. You know, Shias could come in there and pray. They have their own madrasas, okay, that are independent, you know. And you don't see on the social level any kind of tension, you know. I wouldn't doubt that you would have probably elements that might be sectarian. I think this is something that occurs in religious communities by and large. You know, there might be people who might have these types of tendencies, but you don't. When I was there, they were not dominant as an idea in the community. Yeah. So I really don't see a problem. You know, the same was like in Iraq, for example. In Iraq, you know, you had Sunnis and Shias getting married and so on. As soon as the Americans want to take over the oil and so forth, then you find a propagation of anti-Sunni, anti-Shia stuff going on in Iraq. You know, people who were married, you know, families were broken up and so on. And I think, you know, basically when you find these types of phenomena, you have to ask the question, who has the most to benefit from this? You know, I would always go back to basically Western and American interests.
And Masood, I want to ask you again, you know Iran very, very well. Do you think that Iran is perhaps vulnerable to the same type of sectarianism push from the West as, say, other countries in the region have been, like Iraq, for example?
When I went to Qish last year, even I was surprised the level of the unity on the grassroots. I mean, you know, talking to the taxi driver, talking to people around the city, you know, I was so conscious to find out what is really going on that level, because, you know, any other level could be manipulated. And people genuinely were saying, we don't have a problem. There are efforts to create these problems, but we are united. We are so sort of almost together, you know, bonded together. But there are elements, you know, I mean, look, in Iraq, what happened, I remember two British soldiers dressed up in Arab clothes were arrested, armed to the teeth with bombs, and they were arrested. What do you think they were doing? You know, if you go to one community and dressed up as that community and bomb the other side, and then next day go to the other community and bomb the opposite side, even if there are people two sides of same street and have no other difference other than that, they start fighting each other because they see people from that side of the street are attacking this side and from this side to that side. So it's easy to create that. And I've been involved. We have a program called Charter 3103, which is from the verses of Quran, At-tasmu bihamdillahi jami'an. And we go for conflict resolution. We have done this settings in Pakistan, Indonesia, in Malaysia, and it's been extremely successful, bringing people from the Salafi background, from Sufi background, from Shia background. And when you put people together over a few days, praying together, eating together, joking together, and so forth, you see the bonding. And, you know, people going through that process usually come back and they say, look, before we used to go to studio of TV studios and we used to really go for each other. Now, we're ashamed of doing that. Mm. We actually cannot go for each other that way because on the level of heart being brought together. And I think the verse is actually deals with that. It's not a political unity. Allah says, unite. And do you remember the times that you were separate from one another? Then I brought your hearts together. Mm-hmm. So we need to unite on the level of heart, on the level of, you know, brotherhood and so forth. And I think the other really important thing is that they created illusion. Mm. And I've seen it. I was giving a talk once, and a brother from a Salafi background got up. He said, what you're saying about unity is fantastic, but it's impossible. Mm. I told him that, well, look, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala orders us to unite. Do you think Allah is joking with us? They're asking us to do something which is impossible? Mm. The impossibility is being put in our brain, is not the reality.
Wow.
It is possible, and we need to work on it, and we need to get rid of these illusions that the enemy is creating to divide us.
That's a very strong story to end your point on. I'm going to come back to you, Sheikh, on this and ask you about this concept of Islamic unity. I think right now we do live in an age where there does seem to be a divide between Muslim communities on many issues. Sectarianism to a degree perhaps has been partly successful. But do you think that this concept of Islamic unity is possible? And if so, how can we get there?
I don't think it's possible. I think it's natural. It's not just possible, it's natural. I mean, when you look at the history of Islam, okay, you never found a situation. You very rarely would you find a situation where people are forced to convert to Islam, you know, in contradiction to Western propaganda, okay? In fact, what you would find that in the Christian countries, okay, you had more intolerance, okay, than in Muslim countries for other religions, not to mention other Muslim sects or points of view, Okay? So when you look at, for example, classical Spain and Al-Andalus, which was an Islamic country, a 100% Islamic country that was close to 800 years, for 800 years. When you look at the golden age in Iraq, you know, you find a confluence of different thought, Christian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, you know, Pahlavi philosophy and the sciences and so forth. Everybody was free. You found that some of the greatest advances in traditional Jewish thought was under Maimonides, you know, who was living in Islamic Spain and had that freedom to do this.
Yes, that's okay? Right.
Okay? Yeah. All right? So when you could have that type of unity with other religions and cultures, you know, what about between Islam, you know, between Muslims? You see? When you look at the Christian world, however, you know, you have things like the 100-year war, you know, between Christians. You know, you had Christians slaughtering each other.
The Dark Ages, I think, were during the Islamic Golden Age, wasn't it?
You know, when they retook Andalus, you know, you had blood flowing in the streets from Jews and Christians. When the Jews were fleeing this persecution, where did they go? Did they go north to Germany? No, man, they went south to Morocco, because they knew Muslims would be tolerant towards them. This whole new idea of Muslim intolerance and so forth is actually fomented by these puppets of the West. Saudi Arabia, for example. You know, elements within these countries and so forth. So I think we have to be able to be cognizant of history to be able to understand these things.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. Unfortunately, we are out of time. There's so much more we could have discussed, but we'll have to leave it there for the time being. And thank you to everyone at home for joining us for this edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Assalamu Alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scientists continue to raise alarm about the intertwined climate and biodiversity crises, warning that Western countries are losing the ability to lead as they break climate commitments. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, talking in high profile while dragging the feet, such contradictory actions are not sustainable when it comes to dealing with climate change. Only reasonable deeds can be pushed forward in a sustainable way, and only countries with the ability to lead can set an example as pioneers. Unfortunately, the West is losing such ability. According to a Guardian report, the UK will build its first new coal mine in 3 decades at Whitehaven in Cumbria, northwest England. The new mine will take 2 years to build and will produce an estimated 2.8 tons of coking coal a year, which is used in the production of steel. Burning a pound of coal emits 2.7 pounds of carbon dioxide. The UK government seems to be forgetting about the climate commitments it has made in the past. At last year's COP26 climate change conference in the UK's Glasgow, the UK set the goal of accelerating the phase-out of coal. In 2019, it committed to reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said in his speech at this year's COP27 last month that Britain is morally right to honour its climate change commitments. In June, the UK's climate change watchdog warned that the plan to build a coal mine in Cumbria is absolutely indefensible because the resulting pollution would blow holes through the nation's pledge to reduce emissions by 2050. In similar moves, France has rebooted a coal-fired power station to secure the country's electricity supply over the winter. A hard coal-fired power plant in Germany is also back in operation due to the gas supply crisis. While in the US, the Supreme Court ruled in July to limit the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to resist and restrict greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, a significant setback for climate action. Against the backdrop of the Russia-Ukraine crisis, Western countries broke the energy supply-demand balance with Russia, not only dragging themselves into an energy crisis, but also pulling the whole world to bear the consequences. When these old-brand capitalist countries put their narrow interest above the country's long-term interest and the common interest of humanity, this overshadows the efforts in coping with climate change by the world, especially developing countries. Climate change is one of the most important agendas facing humanity. It requires the cooperation of all countries and should transcend geopolitics. But the experiences in the past decades show that in Western countries, climate change actions are subject to their foreign political and economic objectives. This means the West will only talk high, but act low, and be strict with others while loose with itself. This is what hypocrisy entails. For a long time, Western countries have used climate change and carbon emissions as political tools. Behind the climate agenda is a set of geopolitical tools crafted by Western countries to suppress developing countries. They label themselves as a pioneer in coping with climate change, while using climate change as an excuse to block development of developing countries so that they can't continue to enjoy the benefits they once exploited. Be bossy as always and retain their discourse power and dominant position in the international system. The West has not paid back historical debts and now it is owing more. Shen Yi, a professor from Fudan University, told the Global Times that Western countries took the lead in completing industrialization while emitting carbon dioxide recklessly, and they have an obligation to help developing countries reduce carbon emissions. However, Western regimes not only transferred their industries to developing countries to enjoy the high quality and cheap products from developing countries, but at the same time required developing countries to pay for carbon emissions. This is sacrificing some people's interest to realize others' governance model. For the West, emission reduction is not a rigid task, and it is just normal to sacrifice long-term goals for current political objectives. Xiu Liang, an associate professor at the School of International Relations of Beijing International Studies University, believes that Western regimes such as the UK should explain and apologize to the international community because they delay the global process of tackling climate change. But the question is, do these countries have the will to bear international responsibilities? For them, international responsibility is just a false proposition. Meanwhile, the website of Common Dreams noted, with a Global Biodiversity Summit underway in Montreal, Guardian columnist George Monbiot recently took aim at the U.S. for its active and deadly cavalier attitude toward the rest of the world. An example, other nations follow. Although U.S. President Joe Biden recently appointed Monica Medina as the first special envoy for biodiversity and water resources, and his administration is participating in the 15th Conference of the Parties, COP15 of the Convention on Biological Diversity, CBD, the U.S. is notably not a party to the treaty, which was drafted in 1992. In fact, the U.S. is the only United Nations member state not to ratify the treaty. The other 192 UN countries, the European Union, Cook Islands, New, and Palestine are also parties to the CBD, leaving the U.S. in the company of just the Holy See, the government of the Roman Catholic Church.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and hiked interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2020. Two, because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Center for Economics and Business Research has said that the global slide into a recession next year, as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. Right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest.
In November 2022, the Republican Party won the majority of votes to the House of Representatives. They vowed to go after Democrats and President Joe Biden, but now cracks have appeared with the party itself. In a historic incident, the GOP failed to nominate the House Speaker. Party leader Kevin McCarthy got just 203 votes in two rounds, less even than Democrat Hakeem Jeffries in the GOP-controlled chamber, and fared even worse, with 202 votes in round three. It went to six rounds, but yet McCarthy could not gain the votes. It was a tumultuous start to the new Congress and pointed to a difficult road ahead with Republicans now in control of the House. A new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington and were committed to stopping McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. It is widely believed that a revolt of ultra-hardliners has dealt a humiliation to McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, you cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
McCarthy became the first candidate to fall short in a first ballot for Speaker in a century. The impasse means Republicans are unable even to assume the control that they won in the midterms, as the new House can't yet be sworn in. The standoff over McCarthy has been building since Republicans appeared on track to win the House majority in the midterm elections in November. A new generation of Trump-aligned Republicans led the opposition to McCarthy, believing that he's neither conservative enough nor tough enough to battle Democrats.
And they even came to the position where one, Matt Gaetz, said, "I don't care if we go to plurality and we elect Hakeem Jeffries and it hurts the new frontline members not to get reelected." Well, that's not about America, and I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
While the Senate remains in Democratic hands, House Republicans are eager to confront Biden after 2 years of the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. But disagreements to choose the House Speaker is an ominous sign for the party and its conservative agenda. Even if McCarthy succeeds to be the Speaker, he will be a weak figure who may be in office but barely in power. The war, which started with the Tea Party backlash to the Obama administration, is far from over.
We will compromise, but we will not capitulate. And there's a very serious difference. There's 222 Republicans in our conference now. So if 20 people are able to drive this train however they want to, 202 of us might as well go home, because that means they are the conference. That means those 20 people will be the majority. Well, that is capitulation, and we will not do that. Compromise, yes.
The fractious support for McCarthy is over the direction of the GOP between swing district moderates and conservatives who have taken up the populist agenda of the former President Donald Trump. It is now believed that the chaos highlights the dilemma facing House Republicans.
You have 20 people demanding that 201 surrender to them unconditionally. Well, I will not surrender unconditionally. If you have conditions, give them to us. We'll consider them. Doesn't mean we'll do them, but you have to talk about them. But we've asked and we've asked, what is it you want? What do you need? But you have 20 people demanding the unconditional surrender of, including this group of warriors. We will not unconditionally surrender. Tell us what you want. We might surrender if you tell us the terms.
Analysts say no matter the concessions made to some of those on the far right, they simply will not relent and join other Republicans. Crisis is even more poignant as the party is set to brace for the presidential election set to be held in 2024. It now appears the fractures that Trump created within the Republican Party are deeper than ever before. With Trump still desperate to be elected president, it is unlikely the GOP will be able to unite behind another leader and change its electoral fortunes anytime soon. It didn't take more than a day after the most controversial and right-wing cabinet took over in Israel, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. The UNGA acted swiftly and asked the ICJ to consider the consequences for Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories.
Israeli practices and settlement activities affecting the rights of the Palestinian people and other Arabs of the occupied territories. End of quote.
It appeared as though the timing was pre-planned, and that the resolution was a signal to the new administration. Lots of cheers from PA Ambassador to the UN on the matter, though.
This vote and request comes one day after the new Israeli government was formed, pledging to accelerate colonial and racist policies against the Palestinian people.
It came as no surprise that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu had the complete opposite view, saying that Israel is not bound by the UN vote. But does this resolution and referral to the ICJ even make a difference where Israel is concerned, or Palestinians for that matter? Definitely not. The reasons speak for themselves. As far as the ICC is concerned, Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC. This is while the International Criminal Court has determined that it does have jurisdiction over the territories occupied by Israel, despite Israel's insistence to the contrary. So what is the point of all of this if it won't change the facts on the ground? Well, aside from Israel not being a member of the ICC, it disputes its jurisdiction on the basis that Palestine is not a sovereign state that is capable of being a party to the Rome Statute. The UNGA areas of focus have been issues that Israel has not heeded, nor has it even taken into account. Violation by Israel on the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, as well as altering the demographic composition of Al-Quds, is something that Israel has been actively doing. Not only that, coming right out of the gates, this administration has already said that it will go against the resolution. When it comes to the UN, Israel has had the most UN resolutions slapped against it, over 70 in counting. Israel has followed none. The Israeli ambassador, Gilad Erdan, has called the resolution moral stain on the UN. He said no international body can decide that the Jewish people are occupiers in their own homeland, adding any decision from a judicial body which receives its mandate from the morally bankrupt and politicized UN is completely illegitimate. The UNGA resolution also exposes the hypocrisy of the so-called normalization of some Persian Gulf Arab countries with Israel. The resolution had virtually unanimous support from the Islamic world, including Arab states that have normalized relations with Israel.
The new Israeli administration is described as being the most religious and right-wing in Israel's history. So extreme, it has even put it at odds with Israelis inside of Israel. Additionally, it has rattled the cages of Israel's closest allies while escalating tensions with the Palestinians. This new coalition has explicitly called for illegal settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank to be its top priority, vowing to legalize dozens of illegally built outposts and to annex the occupied territory. The incoming Minister of National Security, Ben-Gavir, who will be responsible for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Israeli police, and the Palestinians inside of Israel, has openly called for settlement expansion. Ben-Gavir also supports Jewish prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. Here's another point to consider. The United States, Britain, and Germany have opposed the UNGA resolution. The question that can be asked here is, if these countries voted against the resolution, doesn't that mean that they are in essence giving Israel the green light to go ahead with what the UNGA had proposed, like changing the demographics and the Islamic identity at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or preventing the Palestinians' right of return, and other issues like settlements? The UK ambassador to the UN has already taken a defensive position when it comes to Israel.
We are deeply concerned at instability on the West Bank and call on all sides to work together to urgently de-escalate the situation. The UK will be voting no on the resolution, Israeli practices affecting human rights of the Palestinian people in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, because we do not feel that a referral to the International Court of Justice is helpful in bringing the parties back to dialogue.
What appears to be certain is that the Palestinians may be facing an even bleaker future with this extreme coalition cabinet that has been formed. This can only mean that the crimes against the Palestinians may go into overdrive in this new year. And that is very hard to imagine, given that Israel has already violated Palestinians' right to such extremes that going beyond what has been done already is hard to imagine. It now remains to be seen how the world will react once this administration begins its work in the occupied Palestinian territories.
The United States approved arms sales to NATO allies increased dramatically in 2022 as the war between Russia and Ukraine prompted the bloc's member states into purchasing more weapons. By some estimates, military spending by the United States and its allies is growing at a level without precedent since the end of the Second World War. According to an analysis by Foreign Policy magazine, the number and cash value of arms sales approved by the United States to its NATO allies has nearly doubled in 2022 compared to 2021. According to an analysis of 2 years of data from the U.S. Defense Department's Defense Security Cooperation Agency, in 2021 the U.S. government approved 14 possible major arms sales to NATO allies worth around $15.5 billion. In 2022, that jumped to 24 possible major arms sales worth around $28 billion, including $1.24 billion worth of arms sales to expected future NATO member Finland. While not all arms sales will be finalized with the same number outlined in the proposals, the sharp uptick in these plans reflects a massive shift in Europe's security landscape. This has been the basis for the generation of vast profits for the arms manufacturers, with the U.S. military-industrial complex emerging as the key beneficiary of the war in Ukraine. Under conditions in which the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen by 10% for the year as a whole, the share prices of U.S. defense contractors have surged. Over the past 12 months, the share price of Northrop Grumman has increased 40%, and Raytheon is up by nearly 17%, while Lockheed Martin has surged by 37%. Some of the approved U.S. arms sales in 2022 were years in the making, such as Germany's plan to purchase F-35 fighter jets in a deal worth around $8.4 billion. But many other major arms sales were rushed after the war broke out in Ukraine, as European countries on NATO's eastern flank dashed to bulk up their own military capabilities in an effort to backfill the equipment they shipped to Ukraine and deter Moscow. The United States has already approved plans to sell HIMARS launchers to Estonia and Lithuania, and a similar plan for Latvia is expected to be announced within a matter of months. The major European powers are surging their military spending, with 10 NATO members spending more than 2% of GDP on weapons this year, up from 4% in 2014.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Saudi Arabia continued to infiltrate Wikipedia by recruiting the organization's highest-ranked administrators. The Saudi Arabian government infiltrated Wikipedia with the aim to control the content on the website, a report has said. Saudi Arabia also jailed its two high-ranking officials of Wikipedia, Osama Khaled and Ziad al-Sofiani, for swaying public opinion and violating public morals. Democracy for the Arab World Now, Don, reported. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Fars News Agency wrote in this regard, Saudi Arabia has infiltrated Wikipedia and jailed two administrators in a bid to control content on the website. Activists have said recently, weeks after a former Twitter worker was jailed for spying for the Saudis. One administrator was jailed for 32 years and another was sentenced to 8 years, the activists said, AFP reported. An investigation by parent body Wikimedia found the Saudi government had penetrated Wikipedia's senior ranks in the region, with Saudi citizens acting or forced to act as agents, two rights groups have said. Wikimedia's investigation revealed that the Saudi government had infiltrated the highest ranks in Wikipedia's team in the region. Democracy for the Arab World Now, Down, and Beirut-based SMEX said in a joint statement. Washington-headquartered Dawn, founded by killed Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi and SMAEX, which promotes digital rights in the Arab world, cited whistleblowers and trusted sources for the information. There was no immediate comment from the Saudi government or from Wikimedia, which puts free educational content online through initiatives like Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, and Wiktionary. Dawn and SMEX statement comes after Wikimedia last month announced global bans for 16 users who were engaging in conflict of interest editing on Wikipedia projects in the MENA, or Middle East and North Africa region. In an investigation that started last January, Wikimedia said they were able to confirm that a number of users with close connections with external parties were editing the platform in a coordinated fashion to advance the aim of those parties. Wikimedia was referring to Saudis acting under the influence of the Saudi government, Dawn and SMEX said, citing their sources. Two high-ranking admins, volunteer administrators with privileged access to Wikipedia, including the ability to edit fully protected pages, have been imprisoned since they were arrested on the same day in September 2020, the two bodies added. The arrest appeared to be part of a crackdown on Wikipedia admins in the country. Dawn and SMEX said, naming the two people imprisoned as Osama Khalid and Ziad Al-Sofiani. Abdullah Al-Awda, Dawn's director of research for the Persian Gulf, said Khalid was jailed for 32 years and Sofiani received an 8-year sentence. The arrest of Osama Khalid and Ziad Al-Sofiani on one hand and the infiltration of Wikipedia on the other hand show a horrifying aspect of how the Saudi government wants to control the narrative and Wikipedia, Al-Awda told AFP. Last month, former Twitter worker Ahmad Abu Mao was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison by a San Francisco court for crimes including being an illegal agent of a foreign government. Prosecutors accused Abu Mao and fellow Twitter employee Ali Al-Zabara, who is wanted by the FBI, of being enlisted by Saudi officials between late 2014 and early the following year to get private information on accounts that were critical of the Saudi regime. The website of Middle East Eye had an eye on this issue, writing Saudi Arabia infiltrated Wikipedia by recruiting the organization's highest-ranked administrators in the country as government agents in a bid to control content on the website, activists have reported. Wikimedia, the parent company of Wikipedia, terminated all its administrators in Saudi Arabia in December after an internal investigation to activist group claimed. Wikimedia's investigation revealed that the Saudi government had infiltrated the highest ranks in Wikipedia's team in the region, Democracy for the Arab World Now and Beirut-based SMEX said in a joint statement. The Wikimedia Foundation, which hosts Wikipedia, disputed some of the claims, stating recently that there were material inaccuracies in SMEX and Dawn's statements. The foundation said that its investigation did not find the Saudi government infiltrated Wikipedia, but that some users it banned may have been Saudi. In September 2020, the Saudi government arrested Osama Khalid and Ziad Al-Sofiani, the two high-ranking volunteer administrators at Wikipedia with privileged access to the website, including the ability to edit fully protected pages. The men were handed down jail sentences of 32 years and 8 years, respectively. The arrests were part of a crackdown on Wikipedia administrators in the country. Don and SMEX said the men were prosecuted because they had contributed information deemed to be critical about the persecution of political activists inside the country. It's despicable but entirely predictable that the Saudi government has prosecuted Saudis merely for posting content about the government's human rights abuses, said Raad Jarar, Don's advocacy director. But Wikimedia also needs to take responsibility for the fact that its authorized editors are today languishing in prison for work they did on Wikipedia pages.